On January 25th, 1986, in South Central Los Angeles, Herman Atkins, a disciplined student athlete who enjoyed refurbishing lowrider Chevys, was paying a local mechanic for an engine rebuild when a robber snatched the money and took off on foot. Herman grabbed the mechanic's gun and chased the robber, firing warning shots into the air. The robber turned a corner and Herman heard more gunshots. When he reached the corner, he happened upon another crime scene. There were cop cars and people wounded, and Herman, frightened, ditched the gun and retreated. After blanketing the area and questioning the mechanic, police wanted Atkins in connection with the shooting and wounding of three people, including two police officers, something Herman would be totally unaware of until authorities caught up with him while he was visiting family in Phoenix in November of that year. Fingerprints on the gun found at the crime scene did not match Herman, but with two newborn sons and prosecutors promising a guilty verdict and a terribly long sentence if he went to trial, Herman pled no contest to the charges in exchange for a lighter sentence. But this was just the beginning. On April 8, 1986, while Herman Atkins' picture was being circulated by police in connection with the January 25th incident, an armed man forced a 23-year-old store clerk into the back room of her shop to perform oral sex on him in Lake Elsinore, California, a city Herman had never visited. During the rape, the assailant ejaculated and wiped his semen on her sweater, evidence that would later clear Herman's name. The armed robber and rapist fled with $130 in cash and the victim's jewelry. The victim and two other store clerks in the strip mall identified Herman as the assailant from his circulating wanted poster. With the prosecution relying on this ultimately mistaken eyewitness identification, an incentivized jailhouse snitch, and misleading serology findings, Herman was sentenced to 47 years plus 8 months for a crime he did not commit. This is Wrongful Conviction with Jason Flom. Welcome back to Wrongful Conviction, everyone. Today, you're going to hear a story that has so many layers, so many twists and turns. It's a story that includes mistaken eyewitness identification, bad forensics, police misconduct. And in the end of the day, what it's got is redemption and forgiveness of a type that we have never covered and I've never heard of before. So I hope you're settled in because this is going to be an amazing ride. And with me is the star of our show, Herman Atkins. So Herman, welcome to Wrongful Conviction.
Well, thank you for having me.
And like I always say, I'm sorry you're here, but I'm glad you're here.
Yeah. You know, it's been an interesting journey down a long road.
It certainly has. And it all started on the morning of April 8th, 1986, a long time ago.
Correct.
86, that's the year the Mets won the World Series. That's how long ago that is.
Yes.
And I'll just set the stage, right? So sometime around 11:30 in the morning, a thin, young black man wearing a dark jacket, Reebok shoes, and a gold ring went into a shoe store in Lake Elsinore, California, which coincidentally happens to be a place you've never been to. We'll get into that. And he pretended to be interested in some merchandise, and then he, being the only customer in the store, he pulled a handgun and forced the clerk to perform oral sex on him, threatened to kill her. Horrible crime. During the rape, the assailant ejaculated and he left his semen on her sweater. So there was plenty of evidence to go on. And he took $130, making it a robbery and a rape. He also took her engagement ring and another ring. So her sweater was preserved as evidence. And that's when things get really crazy, right? Because you would seem like a very unlikely guy to be a suspect in this crime or any crime.
Yes.
And that's because you're your stepfather.
He was a highway patrol officer.
California Highway Patrol officer
out of the Torrance Division. He raised me in such a way. I grew up in a regiment type upbringing where there was rules, there were structures, there was high expectations, and there was a lot of pride from him as well as my mother. We lived at the time in South Central LA, which would be considered middle class at the time.
And you were
the third of six kids,
yes,
right?
Yes.
And you had ideas of becoming a patrolman yourself.
Yes, I wanted to follow in my father's footsteps. My father went to the military. He come from Jackson, Mississippi. And, you know, it's horror stories after horror stories, racism, the whole shebang when he grew up. So he was one of the first out of 11 kids, nine boys, the rest girls, to leave Jackson, Mississippi. And so given the stories that he told us, I wanted to follow in his footsteps. He left Jackson, Mississippi, went into the military, and then come from the military into law enforcement. So my path was already cut for me. I distinctly remember when the man went through the police academy and how I had to shine shoes and belt buckles and anything that had brass or chrome or silver to it.
And you were a star athlete as well.
Oh,
that,
yeah.
That
yeah.
comes back in the story later in a very unexpected way.
Yes, yes. My whole life long, I spent time in sports. He kept me and my brothers well into the community and social activities. He felt that that was contribute to a strong foundation and give us the opportunity of learning what it means to work as a team, to follow leadership and eventually become leaders. And so I took to sports and excelled at it from Pop Warner all the way on up to high school.
Football, baseball, the whole shebang.
Yes, yes.
And then this story, like I said, has a really crazy twist right at the beginning of it, actually, because, as I said, you would seem to be an extremely unlikely guy to be a suspect in any crime.
Yes.
You were going to church, mm-hmm. graduated high school, mm-hmm. doing your thing, never been in trouble.
Yes.
And then one day, January 25th, 1986, a crazy thing happened.
I was having an engine rebuilt for a 1974 K5 Blazer, which was the in cars for teenagers at that time. I just turned 18. And the guy wanted $300 to rebuild the engine. I had given him $150 already when I took the engine to him. And he calls me up a week later and says, hey, the engine is complete. Come when you can. I couldn't come until at night. And when I went to go pay him the money, unbeknownst to us, there was an individual watching us from across the street. And he approached the both of us, me and the auto mechanic. And the guy pulls out a gun and tells us we know what time it is and took the money that I was giving to the auto mechanic. He then took off, headed to the corner where two shots was fired and the police were everywhere because they were up on the corner investigating a car accident. So everybody in the area fled. So did I, period. Shortly after that, I didn't think nothing of it.
Well, that's pure chaos. I mean, yes. This is like a crate. That's a movie scene.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
At the time, I didn't think nothing of it. Went home. And at that particular time, I was expected to have my first child being born. I had impregnated a young lady who came for the summer and she lived in Texas. So when she announced that the baby was about to be born, I went to Texas and I was there for 3 months. And while there, my first son was born. And so while I was in Texas, this rape that happened in April transpired. So I wasn't even in the state of California when it had happened. Then I came back and then I went to Arizona to visit family members there. While I was there, they have a project system. And so some guys inside the projects had caused harm to somebody else. Police were called, and everybody who was in the area was lined up as usual, and names were taken. When I gave them my name, they just ran the name and then came back and said, well, you're wanted in the city of Los Angeles, and you're wanted in Lake Elsinore for 2 counts of rape, 2 counts of oil copulation, 1 count of robbery, and 1 count of kidnap. And I'm like, wait a minute, I got the wrong guy. Stop it, you know. And so they was like, no, we're going to extradite you back. No problem. They extradited me within days. When I got back to California, I was able to address the robbery incident and what have you. And the mistake I made at that particular time, I didn't tell them who was the perpetrator in the matter because I actually knew the guy and it was going to be one of those street justice things. I'll catch up with you. You're going to give me my money back because you're going to get beat up. You know, and so that was what my thought process was. So I wound up having to plead nolo contendere to that whole situation, meaning you can hold me responsible, but I'm not admitting to what you claim I had done and what have you. I was the victim in the matter. And so the mere fact that it was a 2-year offense clearly tell you the weakness of the matter. So while we were addressing that, they then shipped me off to Riverside, California, where I learned about these charges. And so in April of 1986, a woman called out of Lake Elsinore, California, and said that she had just been raped and robbed. There was a police car in the vicinity, and she gave a quick description of the perpetrator. Young, thin-built black male, young, about 16 years of age. She said his teeth were small. I got big teeth. She said that he didn't have no scars on his hands. I've had that scar on my hand since, you see that scar right there? I used to box, you know, prize fight when I was young. I was an athlete. And so I had that scar there that ended the career. And she said that he had a ring on this exact finger, but she didn't describe the scar. She said that the perpetrator, the shoes he had on, was actually a pair of Reeboks because it had a flag on it. And so she was able to identify this person to the 911 operator who gave that information to the police officer who was right there on the scene. He was like in the neighborhood. 2 minutes, he arrived at the scene of the crime. He said that they had combed the neighborhood looking for a male of this description. And here's the problem. In that area, it's all white. It's predominantly white.
An African-American man would have stuck out like a sore thumb.
Yes. At 11:30 in the morning, in an outdoor strip mall. This is a busy place. They couldn't find an individual. A detective was then called out. The detective took the young lady to the hospital where a DNA rape kit was formed. They gathered all of the evidence, and then they took her to the police station for further investigation. When they got her there, coincidentally, the wanted poster in the L.A. situation, the robbery incident where I was robbed, was laying on a table. And she looked at it and said, "This is the guy that raped me right here." And it was like, "Are you sure?" She said, "Yes, I'm real sure." And so when they were able to get me into the courtroom where I had an arraignment in Lake Elsinore, California, a place I had never been in, never knew anything about. I was born and raised in South Central Los Angeles. And to this very day, I knew nothing about this city. And having me to come there for arraignment, I am brought out into the courtroom with nothing but white guys. I'm the only black guy on this chain of white guys. But yeah. The part that got me is we're in a jury box, right? And the DA's desk is about maybe 3 feet away from me. I mean, I can hear conversations being held with the DA and his party assistant. And they called my name up and an arraignment had taken place. Plead not guilty and what have you. He said, "Well, Mr. Atkins' attorney is not here yet. And so we'll put him on the back end and we'll proceed further." And so once the judge decided to do that, he then got up, went right into the audience. I'm looking at him, sits next to a woman and says, "Do you see the man that raped you?" She looked right over and said, "Yeah, that's him right there. I'm the only black guy." Now, you got the bailiff in back of me, and the bailiff tell me to look forward, or when he gets me back in the back, he's going to take his billy club and bust my head if I didn't continue to look forward. And all the while, I'm looking at this, and I'm like, yeah, okay. So I can't wait for my attorney to get in so I can tell her about this in-court identification. And so when she did come in, by then, the bell had already been rung. You can't unring it.
Right. And this, I want to really dwell on this for a second, yes. Right? Because you're the only black guy. In a sea of white guys.
Yes.
I mean, you're fucked.
Yes, yes. And we went on with the arraignment, and the date was set for preliminary hearing, at which time I then learned all the ins and outs about the case and what have you. Now, once the preliminary hearing came about, they had stated that they had 3 witnesses that could put me at the scene of the crime. They had a informant who allegedly stopped the detective as he was leaving the county jail and said, "Hey, I heard your address in a rape case in Lake Elsinore. I know something about it. I can help you with it." So the detective pulls this guy out. And lo and behold, this informant was supposed to tell him he knew me, that I had relatives in Lake Elsinore. And I was in Lake Elsinore around about the time that this rape had taken place. Then this is what the informant had told him. Told him what kind of car I drove. Told him where I actually came from, which was in the city of Los Angeles, and that he had relatives in Los Angeles, and that's how he was able to know me as well. Then when the detectives had came to L.A. County to see me for the first time, they had taken items that was in my property. At the time, I was off into hip hop, you know, rapping and things of that nature. And so quite naturally, I fit the bill of what New York would call a B-boy or what have you, with the big gold chain, the Reebok tennis shoes. I had a nugget ring. And so they took all of this and took it to the victim and showed it to the victim. The victim told him, no, none of that. He didn't have none of that. But what they did was, is they put it all in the bag. And when we went to trial, they used it just saying, we took this from Mr. Atkins. This is what he had. This is what the victim originally said that the perpetrator had, and it's here in the bag. And so it was used as evidence.
So they mixed your clothes with the clothes that might look like what she would have remembered.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes.
That's
deep. Yes. I mean, but that's the police misconduct part of it. Then there was the prosecutorial misconduct of it, where prosecutor Richard Bentley lines up with a serologist and manipulated numbers to tell the juries that I couldn't have been excluded from the crime when in actuality I could have. They said that I had a rare blood type, and this blood type, only 5% of the nation had this blood type. And because I fit into that 5% of the nation blood, I couldn't have been excluded. When in actuality, it was the other way around. I was in the 95% that could have excluded me right there from the spot. And that's all that Richard Bentley had to do, was to be truthful with the matter instead of manipulating the matter. Because what the serologist had done, it was proven in a civil trial that he had, in fact, conspired with Richard Bentley to misquote these numbers. In the civil trial, which I love, that came, you know, almost 2 decades later, and found that Danny Miller, the lead detective, was liable for his role that he played in my being wrongfully convicted. Richard Bentley got to hide behind the badge of immunity, where he couldn't be held responsible for what role he played in it. And James Hall, who was the serologist, he was able to escape because of an issue that the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals released him on.
Yeah, that's crazy.
I was shocked to see how the pieces to the puzzle had came about as a result that led to my being wrongfully convicted. I realized that there was, in fact, a conspiracy. I realized that there was prosecutorial misconduct. There was police misconduct. There was misidentification. There was junk science involved that all led to my being wrongfully convicted.
First of all, before we even get to the jury and the verdict, there's an important thing which hurts me to even talk about. I can't imagine how it feels for you, but your father during this time, who you obviously looked up to tremendously, you wanted to follow in his footsteps.
Yes.
And he taught you so much, but he didn't stand by you.
No.
He took the side of the police over his own son.
In his exact words, quote unquote, I went with the evidence instead of the love of the child.
And on top of everything else that you were going through, I can't imagine how a young person like yourself at this time, barely out of your teenage years, can process that abandonment.
It was an act of treason to a father-son relationship.
The jury goes out. Did you have any hope that you would be found innocent after you had watched this whole thing take place in front of your eyes? You were living in it, right? Did you think they were going to come back and find you guilty?
No. I thought that...
The truth would win.
Yeah, the truth. My grandmother had a saying. She said, a lie or die, but the truth will always live on. And so I applied that to that situation. Unfortunately, it didn't happen then. It happened later on, but everything my father had ever taught me about the justice system,
It
went out the window. Herman, America got the best justice system.
It's not the worst in the world, but it needs a lot of improvement.
And as I have grown and have matured and have walked through this journey, I realize what the justice is. There's nothing wrong with Americans' justice system. It's the people that work within the justice system that has given it a bad name.
Right, because in your case, if they would have followed the rules, you would have been exonerated.
Yes.
You wouldn't have even been brought to trial.
Yes.
Nobody would have prosecuted this case. They would have kept looking. They come back in and find you guilty on all counts.
Mm-hmm.
So that moment must have been the worst moment of your life.
Oh, yeah. Can you imagine hearing a sentence, we give you 47 years and 8 months in prison? I was devastated. I mean, you have to understand, at the time, although I was age 21, I was one of them late bloomers. So I still 5'11". I weighed maybe 145 pounds wet. And when I went back to the cell where I was being housed at, there was a police officer. He believed in me. And although I never talked to him about, or anybody for that matter, about the case, he knew that I didn't commit that crime because he had came on his shift and he had found out what had happened. And he racked the door and he said, "Atkins, you know, step out." And he took me out and he put me in a padded cell and gave me a roll of toilet paper. And he said, "I'll be back to check on you." And when he put me in that cell, I cried like a baby. That's when I realized you can lose your, you know, emotions and for 3 hours, I just cried. I didn't have anybody to console me. My father wasn't there to, you know, hey, with that motivational speech. My mother wasn't there to, you know, with her solutions to every problem. None of that. I was just, you know, stripped down to nothing. That was just me right there. And I knew that at that moment, I was about to go on a journey. I was frightened, but I didn't know what to expect. But it was just, it just tore me apart. And my father, when I was young, I was always willing to help people and what have you. My father used to always say, "Herman, you have a soft heart, but that's all right. Life will harden it for you." And what he said, he was right, because my heart became instantly hard. I developed hatred in my heart. When I got to prison, my attitude was, "I'm in here for something I didn't do. I'm going to give you a reason to kill me because I don't see a way out." And so my attitude was, when it came from an authoritative figure, "Atkins, you need to fuck you. Atkins, you need to fuck you. Atkins, come here." I became what's called a management problem. I can honestly say I kind of checked out mentally and emotionally.
And you had grown by now into a big, tough guy, right?
I grew over a period of time. But, you know, by the time I had did my 7th year and a shoe program later, by the end, I'm 6'1", and I'm weighing every bit of 200 pounds. I did a 16-month shoe program. And
by shoe, you mean secure housing.
Yeah, unit, segregated right? housing unit, and where you stayed in a cell 23 hours out of a day, 30 minutes for a shower and 30 minutes for yard, and seldom did you get both. Doing that right there and talking to a guy that was over in the cell who was doing an indeterminate shoe program. He had been there 8 years already. And he and I used to talk to a vent about that, like that right there, except it was on the wall. And he told me something that was just registered to me. He said, "If what you're telling me is true, then you need to get back out on the main line, get into the law books and figure out what happened to you and get up out of here." Made sense to me. I straightened up, did the shoe program, hit the main line, and kind of stayed to myself other than working and then law library.
And from there, I mean, it took another 5 years to get out. What led you to the Innocence Project? How'd you get out?
Okay, well, in 1994, when I got out of the shoe program, I went to the law books. I hit them hard. I studied everything that had to do about a rape case. And there was a guy who had came in. He was doing a violation. He did like a 9-month violation. He had been watching me from a distance. You know, he said, "Look, man, you're kind of young to be in the law books the way you are, you know." And he said, "What are the issues that you're fighting or whatever?" Because I know a little bit of something about law. And in prison, you know, rapists and a child molester are treated lower than the dirt they walk on. So I never told nobody about, you know, what I had been in for. But it was a calmness about this guy. And I told him. He said, "Well, what are the issues?" And I told him that. He said, "Well, it seems as though that you have chopped down a tree and you're still dealing with a stump." He said, "There's an organization that could help you get out of here. It's called the Innocence Project. And I'm more than sure if you, you know, ask them to help you, they'll take your case. You can be out of here in months." I went in, wrote a 13-page letter, and Barry Scheck and Peter Neufeld sent me a letter saying, "We would be interested in your case. Can you send us your sentencing transcript, your serologist report, and your trial transcripts?" And me and my family got together. We sent these documents. About 2 weeks after we had sent it off, I got a letter from Barry Scheck, Peter Neufeld, again, telling me that they not only would they accept my case, they broke down how the Innocent Project worked and the fact that a student would be assigned in my case and what the student job was. And if they were successful at finding the evidence for DNA testing, then it would be turned over to an in-house attorney and that person would go and represent me. Now, from the time they told me that in 1994, the evidence was found in 1997. The problem was is that the Innocent Project was a fairly new organization, and so they didn't have attorneys around the nation willing to do the work that they were doing, especially for a pro bono like they have now. And so it took them another 2 years with the assistance of my family as well to find an attorney. And they found one guy named Douglas Myers. He stepped up. He argued successfully to have the evidence released. And it was released in October of 1999, at which time it was tested. And it proved that I was factually innocent of these crimes. The DA, they just did not want to concede on the matter. So they wanted to be slick and asked Berryshek and the courts to have a second DNA testing. They wanted to send everything to Berkeley, California for another testing and what have you, which would have cost me to be there even longer. But Berryshek got smart and told him, he said, let's get the FBI involved. And they sent it to the FBI. And while Berryshek and Peter Neufeld, they had wrote a book and they were on a book tour, the FBI found out what the results were and tried to make it seem like they discovered that an innocent man was in prison and they were the ones that pressed for my immediate release. And so the minute order came down February 17th of 2000, demanding my immediate release because I had been proven by way of post-conviction DNA testing that I was factually innocent of the charges some 12 years later. But it was a total of 14 because the moment they put handcuffs on you, that's when the clock starts.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. So it's a total of 14 years.
So 14 years.
Mm-hmm. Never received an apology from Richard Bentley, Danny Miller, James Howe, nor the victim for that matter. But in coming home, you can actually see me go to YouTube, type in Herman Atkins DNA testing, and you're going to see a video of my immediate release.
What was it like walking out?
Everything was new to me. I had lost touch with society. I had been gone over a decade. But as far as coming home, I was excited about that because I did make plans while I was in there. I knew one day, you're going to have to let me go.
And they did.
And they did.
And yes. So you walked out. What's the first thing you did when you got out?
Well, as far as eating.
Or anything.
Well, the first thing I did, my mother and my sister and her husband and an auntie and one of my sons who had been born before I went in, he was 1 year old when I went to prison. He was 14 years old when I got out. And so we all stopped at IHOP. And one of the things I noticed is I had ate prison food so long, I couldn't keep nothing on my stomach. So we bypassed that. And I had to actually go to a dollar store in California and buy stuff that they sold in the canteen. I had to make prison spreads in order to eat and survive out here for at least a month.
That's crazy.
And then they took me to a hometown buffet. And something about their food set on my stomach. So I mauled their food. And we would drink coffee up in there, like four Folgers coffee. I went to Starbucks and brought some coffee from there. I stayed up for 3 days, literally 3 days. My sister said, Herman, what's wrong with you? Are you all right? I said, yeah, Beta. Starbucks got some strong coffee. I don't mess with Starbucks coffee to this very day.
Because the prison coffee was so weak. That's going to stick with me a long time, the story about you eating prison food after you got out for a month. That's crazy.
Yeah.
So you went to college out.
Yeah, when I came home, work was not an option. I needed to be educated. I already had a high school diploma. I went enrolled in college. And once I got there, I went to the head coach and told him, hey, this is my story. I want to play football. And so when I came home, I still had that 21-year-old mentality. And I looked like I was about 22, 23 at best. And so although I was 34 years of age, he said, well, if you can make the team, you're in. So spring training came around. It was a lot of conditioning and running. And we had to do this final test. And then I made the team. And once I made the team, they gave us helmets, shoulder pads, all of that. And I was able to show them what I was made of physically at age 34. I was out there rocking these 18 and 19-year-old kids who was coming out of high school, All-American defensive end, All-American linebacker, you know, and what have you. And I'm like, yeah, okay. But I was out there tearing them apart. And I had hit a guy so hard one time, I knocked myself out. And so the coach took my helmet, which was my prized possession. I had to sit out for a week for concussion purposes and what have you. But we got back at it, and I played college football for 2 years at that particular college.
In your mid-30s. And then one of the more extraordinary things about, well, I was going to say about your story, but really about you, is the aspect that deals with your father and how you dealt with this betrayal, this treason.
Act of treason.
Yeah. which is, you know, as someone who I grew up, you know, my father was my hero. And, you know, and I can't even imagine on any level how empty and horrible that must have felt. But you did something that I think is extraordinary. And can you talk about that? I mean, what happened with you and your dad when you got out?
Yes, it's one of them situations where, like, when I remember coming up and my father always demanded an explanation as to why I'd done something. And so all I remember during that time and coming home is that this man never came to visit me. He never wrote me. He never sent me money, packages, or none of that. So he was like, he turned his back on me. But he did always tell us, you know, I don't go visit people in jail. I put people in jail. I'm like, okay. So that was my thought then. And it wasn't until we did the documentary After Innocence with Mark Simon and Jessica Sanders, and they interviewed him, but they never told me what he had told them until the documentary was complete and it was now on the big screen. And I'm sitting in this theater and I'm watching him. And when they did his interview, out of his mouth came the explanation as to why he did what he did. He said, I went with the evidence instead of the love of the child. And I immediately got up after that registered with me. I got up while the documentary was still going. I went to the hallway. I called my father. I said, you know, I always wondered why you did what you did, but I just heard your explanation. And it was at that moment I forgave him because I understood that once you become a police officer, you are trained to think a certain way. And now that I'm going to law school, I'm being trained to think a certain way. He was trained to go with the evidence. I'm being trained to go with the facts and make sure that the evidence lines up with the facts. So I was able to forgive him right then and there. And this happened in 05 when I just really got my explanation. And I went to my father and I told him, I forgive you. I get it. I understand. However, since the day I came home, my father has been spending majority of our time, and I've been home in 19 years, he has been spending majority of that time trying to make it up to me for the decision that he made. And I've been spending my time showing him I forgive you. You're my father. I love you. I talk to him regularly. I go visit him. But now I have to do it more so now than I have done over the last few years because now he's dealing with Alzheimer and it's creeping up on him fast. And then I'm forced to stay with him to the bitter end because my greatest fear is now about to confront me. One day he's going to forget who I am. He's going to forget that decision he made. He's going to forget every life lesson that he taught me. He's going to forget
everything.
Yes.
Now you have a bunch of grandchildren.
Yes, I got 7 of them.
Yeah, so that's great. You'll be graduating law school.
Yes.
Awesome. And then California has never compensated you. And that is obviously completely unacceptable. It's ironic because you were one of the people that was really responsible for changing the compensation statute in California.
Yes.
It used to be, believe it or not, I'll let you tell it.
Well, it used to be $10,000. If you can prove that you were wrongfully convicted, you can get $10,000. Well, first of all, we didn't even know that law was on the books. Somehow or another, ACLU found it, and a couple of more other Sharp attorneys found it. And we went in address, meaning me, several other exonerees, Natasha Minsker for the ACLU. We went before a panel. We were able to get that change from $10,000 total to $100 a day. And when I doubled back to apply for it, they told me, you gets nothing because statute of limitations have ran out on you. I'm like, huh? Really? California owed me a $500,000.
Yeah, and I think even then, $100 a day, that's $36.5 a year. Mm. And I think you'd have a hard time going out on the streets and asking people if they want to go into the situation.
You're in a maximum security prison
for $100 a day. You're not going to get a lot of takers for that.
They could give me, it'd be in their best interest to give me my money now, because once I become an attorney, then I'm going to come get it another way, and I'm going to keep getting it and getting it. And when they ask me, well, why are you these lawsuits and this, that, and other? Well, hell, you should have gave me my money.
Right. And now you're going to get it on behalf of other
people. I'm
going to
get it.
Right?
Yes.
Yeah. It's ironic, you being a football player, and there they were moving the goalposts on you, right? But that's the way it goes. So everything about your story is extraordinary. I'm really grateful that you shared your story with my audience and with me here on Wrongful Conviction. And then now comes my favorite part of the show. This is the part of the show where I get to actually just thank you, as I just did. Mm-hmm. And then turn my microphone off and just listen. And I leave it to you for the last few minutes for closing thoughts of anything you want to talk about, anything we didn't
really
cover. Yeah, it's all you. It's your stage. Here
okay, you here's the thing. I travel this nation. I speak on judicial reform. I work closely with the Innocent Project. I have dedicated my life to the work that they do. And there are some things that I found that contribute to our justice system being seriously flawed. But I first present this to anybody to hear my story. I say, each one teach one. Teach one, each one. And I present that challenge to the person, meaning what you have heard here today, go out and educate the next person, because awareness is very important to solving any situation. And in this case, people need to be aware of the fact that we have a seriously flawed justice system. It has accounted for individuals being wrongfully convicted. There's a few individuals that has been killed in the justice system as a result of being wrongfully convicted and executed. And these are the things that need to stop. Now, the solution is let's start at the base of the problem. See, it's not the justice system. I've come to realize the justice system will work perfectly if we get the right people to operate within it. And the problem comes into play at is when you got corrupt prosecutors who's getting wrongful convictions or causing wrongful conviction because they want to be politicians. They want to be judges. They want to be, you know, councilmen and what have you. And because of that, they're willing to do anything to get a conviction. Then you got these corrupt police officers, Lord, not to mention how they just out here killing black males like it is the thing to do, like it's perfectly legal. Okay, we're dealing with a psychological problem. From the police department, we need to do two things. We need psych evaluation on these police officers, get them out of the way. And those that has caused problems, we need to, by way of pitchers motions, we need to go into their background, figure out who they are, and start protesting to get them up out of there. And when you have a DA that don't want to file a case when clearly there has been a violation of the law on behalf of the police, they don't want to file a case, then we need to start looking at that DA and shut that person down, you know, when it comes down to elections and things of that nature. And you got to always remember who these people are, because what you fail to realize is the very people who was hollering back in the 80s and the 90s, tough on crime. Yeah, well, these people has caused a serious problem to Americans' justice system. It's busting at the seams. Taxpayers is paying for it. And now the taxpayers is looking back on it and they say, wow, we can't afford to keep inmates. Start letting them out, letting the ones with nonviolent offenses out, this, that, and other. Why? So you can cut the cost? Well, you should have thought about that when these politicians was hollering tough on crime. So in fact, let's weed them individuals out and get rid of them. Get them out of office as well. We need to overhaul our justice system by removing the very individuals that are creating the problems. I would like to see laws change. I would like to see, when it comes down to compensation, that every state in America follow suit. I like how Texas has set their compensation package up. And every state in America should follow that. I think that should be a federal law that all states has to do one thing in all honor of compensation. One of the things that people fail to realize is that a person who has actually committed a crime can get out in any state and go to government-funded organizations and receive all types of help and resources to acclimate themselves back into society. A person who has been wrongfully convicted, such as myself, is told to go back out in society and function the best way you can. There is no compensation package wherever a person has been proven wrongfully convicted where he can go get an education, where he can go and get housing, where he can get transportation, where he can get psychological help, where he could turn around and be a productive citizen in society with some type of employment or what have you. There's nothing set up for that. And so I'd like to see that change. I'd like to see laws like that change. But the biggest thing I want to see happen, and I pray to God that I live to see it happen, is have that badge of immunity removed from them prosecutors. If you violate the very law that you swore to uphold and protect, then you should be prosecuted by it if you have indulged in the taking of a person's life. Because when you put somebody in prison, be it for a day, be it for a month, be it for a year, be it for a decade, you have killed that person. You have killed that person. And the person that did it, the people that's involved, be it the prosecutors, be it the police, they all need to be held accountable for their actions. So I want to see accountability. I want to see that badge of immunity removed, not in one state, in all states. In all states, in all cities, regardless of how big or small or what have you. And I would like to see society as a whole start focusing on what's going on over in Kansas with this Beluski. Oh, my God. That right there is textbook corruption. And if it went on there, it's just like the same thing that went on in California with the Rampart Division scandal. This stuff right here is common. The only thing that's bringing it to light now is social media. I thank God, because the regular media is not going to televise what a person holding a camera up to the situation would televise. That means it's up close and personal. And I thank God that you have those that hold your camera up. I advise that you hold them up high, because it is your heart, is your courage in the face of these corrupt police officers that is bringing about the truth in the matter.
Thank you. Dropping a lot of knowledge. And if you want to learn more about the Lubsky, listen to the Lamont McIntyre episode of Wrongful Conviction. You'll hear all about it. Thank you again for being here, Herman Atkins. And thank you, everyone, for listening. And I'll see you next week on Wrongful Conviction. Don't forget to give us a fantastic review wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps. And I'm a proud donor to the Innocence Project, and I really hope you'll join me in supporting this very important cause and helping to prevent future wrongful convictions. Go to innocenceproject.org to learn how to donate and get involved. I'd like to thank our production team, Connor Hall and Kevin Wardis. The music in the show is by 3-time Oscar-nominated composer Jay Ralph. Be sure to follow us on Instagram at Wrongful Conviction and on Facebook at Wrongful Conviction Podcast. Wrongful Conviction with Jason Flom is a production of Lava for Good Podcasts in association with Signal Company No. 1.